Support for this episode of the podcast comes from our patrons at Patreon. Go to patreon.com/chasingearhart to join the chase and become a patron today. On the morning of July 2nd, 1937, Amelia Earhart and her navigator Fred Noonan disappeared over the Pacific Ocean without a trace. 81 years later, all over the world lie scattered pieces of their puzzle, waiting to be put together. Welcome to Season 2 of the Chasing Earhart Podcast.
I met my first husband, and it was after he was in the Air Force and was killed overseas that I heard about the program that Jackie Cochran had for training women to be military pilots. And when I saw that article, I thought, as long as my first husband was killed, I would like to be in his place in the Air Force and fly airplanes.
Sweetwater, Texas, 1943. The U.S. is locked in the throes of World War II, and there's a desperate shortage of pilots. These women have answered a nationwide call to be part of a new group. They are members of the Women's Air Force Service Pilots, known as the WASP. There was resistance to the idea that these pilots could fly military aircraft for one reason. They were women. But through hard work and determination, these women proved the naysayers wrong. The WASP flew over 60 million miles in every type of U.S. military aircraft, performing nearly every duty the men did. The WASP provided a crucial service for their country, but it took decades to recognize their contribution.
I can't stress this enough. B. Haydu is a legend. Over 10 years ago, when doing pre-research for what would become Chasing Earhart, B's story came to my attention, and I haven't been able to shake it since. At 97 years old, B continues to inspire women all over the world with the WASP story, and she does it with a sense of humor, humility, and poise that we at the project have never seen before. Knocking down barrier after barrier, B and the other women of the WASP program face trials, criticism, and doubt along their journey. But that never deterred them from fighting for their right to serve their country by flying. Tonight, on the landmark 60th episode of the Chasing Earhart podcast, and in Season 2's first episode of its Icon series, B joins us via Zoom from Florida to discuss women Air Force service pilots, her role as a beacon of aviation, and why she believes that Amelia Earhart and the 99s laid the foundation for women to become empowered and rightfully cement themselves into aviation history. We have had some pretty remarkable people as project guests on Chasing Earhart thus far, but every once in a while, we pull ourselves a legend. And my guest tonight doesn't really need an introduction, but I'll try anyway. Since the inception of this project over a decade ago, countless people have been asking for her. They've told me that we would be crazy to try and pull off a project like this and not include her, and I couldn't agree more, and tonight, here we are. She's one of my original 25. B. Haydu, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. It's my honor to welcome you to Chasing Earhart.
It's my honor to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
So to start, B., I'd like to ask you the same opening question that I've asked every guest that's ever sat down and appeared on the show, but with you, we're going to do a little bit differently. Can you tell us about your education and your professional background prior to joining the WASP program?
Well, my education involves going to high school, and that was it. I was brought up during the Depression years, and there was just not enough funding in the family to send both my brother and I to college. And of course, he was 13 months older than I, and a lot smarter, and he got a scholarship. But I went out into the working world, and I was a secretary. I started as a receptionist and worked my way up to private secretary, but always regretting that I did not have a college education. So one day I said, stop feeling sorry for yourself and do something about it. I looked into night courses at the Newark College of Engineering in New Jersey and saw that there was a course in aviation. I really wasn't sure what I wanted to study. So I said, well, aviation's here to stay. I'll study that. Well, it actually was leading me to be able to pass the written examination for my private pilot's license. At the end of the course, I said, I think I'll take a flying lesson. And it just so happened that the instructor of that course also had a flight school. So I went up to his flight school, which was just the other side of the river in Pennsylvania, because it was wartime and there was no civilian flying in the northern part of New Jersey. And I went there and took a flying lesson. And the first time I was up, I was hooked. So that's actually how I got started in aviation and in flying. From there, we read in the newspaper, there were several of us taking flying lessons. We read in the newspaper that Mrs. Sheehy was coming to Newark to interview prospective women for the Women Air Force Service pilots. So six of us went down with our logbooks and with all of our paperwork that was necessary. And we were all accepted in the same class, which was 44-7.
Now, the WASP program, correct me if I'm wrong, it started in 1943, correct?
41, actually, with Nancy Love.
Okay.
But that was the WAFS, which later became the WASP.
Okay. So if we look at 43 as the benchmark, this was six years after Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan disappeared over the Pacific Ocean. I want to ask you personally, just from a personal standpoint, do you have any early recollections of Amelia Earhart? And do you remember the disappearance when it made headlines?
Oh, I certainly do. The news was worldwide. You know, everyone was interested in that. They all liked Amelia Earhart. And so we all were very interested in it. It was extremely newsworthy.
Can you tell everyone how you got the nickname Bee?
Yes. When I was flying, my friends all used to say she flies like a bumblebee, and the bee stuck. So I don't know whether they meant that as a compliment or not, but I took it as such.
Do you remember the first time you went up in an airplane and what that feeling was like for you?
Oh, it's a wonderful feeling. Anyone who flies, I'm sure, will tell you the same story. It's a feeling of freedom, and you forget any worries that you might have or bad days that you were experiencing when you got up in the air and you looked down and there were these toy cars and toy locomotives and little people walking around. It's just a feeling of freedom. You have flown. What is your reaction when you get up there?
Yeah, you know, I think you put it really nicely. It really is a feeling of freedom. It is something that it's hard to sort of put it into words because you feel like you can go anywhere, you can do anything. There's no geographical limit anymore. And I think at a time in really the golden age of aviation when people were starting to first get up in the sky, I think that must have been really no words, just overwhelming to them that they could do that.
Yes, and also very enlightening too, you know. Golly, we did it without flapping our wings, although they did do that, right? The first airplane, it did have movement on the wings.
Yeah, that's very true. Now, I want to ask you something for those that may not know. Can you give us a bit of an overview of the WASP program?
We were formed to relieve men for active duty. In other words, pilots were needed in this country to do all of those things. And what a lot of people don't realize is that for every combat pilot, you need at least 12 service pilots, because you need instructors to teach you from the very beginning. You need instructors to teach you to fly an aircraft that you might be assigned to. You might be assigned to a B-25 or a PT-22 or any aircraft. So you need an instructor to teach you that. So there are a lot of instructors needed, and there's a lot of work to be done in this country before they're even sent off to combat. So we were formed not to fly in combat. We were only allowed to fly in the United States and Canada.
Now, I've always been curious about this next question, and we talked about this on the phone a few weeks ago, but I'm hoping that you can provide some insight to our listeners on this. As you mentioned earlier, the WASP program formed approximately 6 years after the Amelia Earhart disappearance. Were any of the women, your fellow WASPs, were they inspired by Amelia in any way? Did anybody ever talk about that to you?
Not really. I think I was inspired by the 99s, which Amelia was one of the original founders of, because they do such great work. They really do. They work with like the Boys and Girls Club, and they teach young people that there is a career in aviation. It doesn't all have to be pilots. There's so many different jobs. And I think they do an exceptional amount of work. And I've been a member for over 50 years. So I still work with them, and we do work with the Boys and Girls Clubs. I think they do excellent, excellent work.
Can you tell us a little bit about the training process for the WASP program?
Well, you used to have primary, basic, and advanced. In other words, you start on a lower horsepower aircraft. But I learned on a 65 horsepower side-by-side tail aircraft. And we started in training in a PT-17 Stearman, which is 220 horsepower. And they wanted to see if they could eliminate one of the phases. In other words, they chose the basic. Instead of going primary, basic, advanced, you went primary, advanced. So you went directly into the AT6, which is 650 horsepower. And they said, well, let's try it out on the WASP. And if they can do it, then that's what we're going to do. We're going to change our curriculum to go directly from a primary aircraft into a basic, an advanced aircraft. So this is one way that they utilized us.
What was, I guess, for coming from training to active duty, what was active duty service like while you were in the program?
Well, you had two commands. You had either the ferry command or the training command. Of course, all of us wanted to be in the ferry command because you got to fly a lot of different aircraft. You were always striving to fly something big, bigger, better, faster. So I chose the ferry command, so naturally I got the training command. And I was stationed at Pecos, Texas, and my job there was a utility pilot. In other words, an aircraft had been overhauled and had to be flown in a certain manner for a certain number of hours. That was one of my jobs. Or I had to fly someone on a Sunday, for instance, a chaplain had to be flown from base to base to give his sermons. So there were many aspects to the job.
I want to ask you if you can recall, and this is kind of an interesting and can be a fun question, but it can be kind of tough, I guess, too. Was there can you pick out a low point and a high point in your career?
Well, of course I can pick out the high point, and that's when I graduated. I finally made it. We were always, always so afraid of washing out. I mean, you had to pass not only a civilian test, but you had to pass an Army test too. They had inspectors that came in and took you flying and tested you. So that would be my highest point. My lowest point would be when we were disbanded December 20th, 1944. We were told that if the program was a success, that we would be taken into the Army Air Corps. Well, it was a success, but the promise was never fulfilled.
Can you tell everybody about the disbanding of the WASP program and how that affected the women that were serving in that program and how that affected you personally?
Well, at that time, General Marshall went to General Arnold and said, I desperately need 3,000 men. General Arnold said to General Marshall, okay, I can spare the next class of cadets that are going to go into training. Well, of course, the cadets heard that and were in an uproar. they wanted to fly. They didn't want to be in the infantry. So when the bill, which had to go before Congress, went before Congress, they had so much adverse publicity against us, most of which was not true, that the bill was rejected. And so consequently, we were disbanded.
What did you do after the disbandment? What was your, from a personal standpoint, what was your next step in your career at that point?
Well, I wanted to continue flying, and I wanted to make a career out of it. So I started, we had some advance notice that we were going to be disbanded December 20th, 1944. So I started writing letters to airlines and manufacturers seeking a job. And I didn't have as much experience as the pilots that were coming back from combat. And so I was rejected. I never heard no said so many different ways. And I said, well, if you're going to continue flying, you're going to have to do it on your own. I came back to New Jersey, which was where I lived with my parents. And I got my instructor's rating. So I did freelance instructing. And now they were beginning to manufacture for civilian aircraft. So I went to New York City and talked to the distributor and said, who's going to be bringing your airplanes in? And he said, what have you got in mind? I said, well, I know a lot of qualified pilots, so we can ferry them in. So I got the job of ferrying the Cessna and the Aronca trainers into the New York metropolitan area. Well, that in turn led to my getting a dealership on the Cessna and Aronca. And they had a very good commission set up. This all had to be done in one fiscal year. If you sold 20 airplanes in that fiscal year, you got 10% on the first 10. Then you got 15% on the next five retroactive. So now you're getting 15% on all of them. Then you got 20% on the 20th airplane, providing it was all done with that within that fiscal year. So you better believe I sold 20 airplanes one fiscal year, even though I had to buy the last two myself. However, I took those two aircraft and joined a group of veterans. There were eight of us all together, and we were starting a flight school. That was in Island, New Jersey. That, in turn, was put out of business because Garden State Parkway was being built, and it cut off one of our runways, which put us below minimums, so we were without an airport. About that time is when I met my husband, Joe Haydoo, and he was a pilot, of course. We got married. At that time, he owned a Staggering Beach. And the two of us continued flying up until our late 70s. And we owned about 14 different airplanes. We'd have one and fly it, and then Joe'd find another one that, oh, let's try that one. Or we'd sell that one and buy the other one and so forth. So we just had a lot of fun flying.
Now, in 1975, you were elected president of the WASPs. Can you tell us what that was like for you, for that honor?
I served two terms. And at that time, Colonel Arnold, who was General Arnold's son, said, I will assist you women in getting the recognition that had been denied you. So he had Senator Barry Goldwater said that he would put in the bill to have us made a part of the Army Air, the Air Forces at that time. Consequently, we had to appear before Congress and we had to show proof. In other words, you can't just get up there and say, this is what we did. You have to show maybe a copy of an order or some kind of documentation to prove that you were treated as military, which we were. So we were able at that time to finally get recognition as veterans of World War II.
What was that like for you? Did you feel a sense of vindication after all those years that you finally made that happen?
Oh, absolutely. You know, this is all we wanted. You know, we didn't want money. Of course, we do have the benefit of being able to use the VA hospital and facilities and so forth. But that isn't what we wanted. We wanted the recognition, especially since they had been coming out and saying, we have finally decided to allow women to fly, and this is the group that are going to be the first women to fly military aircraft. Well, of course, you know, you can only imagine how irate all of us were. That, whoa, wait a minute, we were the first, but we finally won.
I want to ask you about impact and legacy, because if Chasing Earhart is about anything, we're about the impact and legacy of course, of Amelia Earhart. But I want to ask you in this particular aspect, what you believe to be the impact and legacy of the WASP program. What do you want that to be? What do you believe it is now? And can we do anything to change that, to make it better?
I think the legacy should be that you can do anything that you want, providing you put your mind to it and your effort to it. And it doesn't matter whether it's an unusual occupation or what it is, but you can do anything. And this is what I like about the 99 group, that they teach that to the young people, that, you know, there's more than a job. It's a job doing something that you really like.
And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about your personal thoughts on what you think the impact and legacy is of someone like Amelia Earhart.
I think the fact that she, along with the other women, had the foresight to put together a group of women that would let the world know that women fly and what women can do. I think she'll go down in history forever for having done that. They had their first meeting in Long Island, and they decided to get the women pilots that they knew from all over the country to come together, which they did in Long Island. They didn't know what to name the group, but there were 99 of them, so they named it the 99s.
Makes sense to me. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what your personal legacy is, because you've been doing a lot of media, a lot of press, a lot of people have been coming to you asking for your personal thoughts on the WASP program. I know you were in Fly Like a Girl, the documentary that's coming out, and you've been doing a lot of that promotional. Can you tell me what that experience has been like for you?
Well, I think it's great to be able to talk to young people and let them know there are all kinds of opportunities out there for a career. I've written one book, which was when I was in service. I wrote Letters Home, and the book is called Letters Home, 1944-1945, which is when I served. And my mother had saved them, along with the letters that my brother had written home. He was serving overseas. I've gotten a lot of good feedback on that. You know, people didn't realize, and they just... Reading through the letters that I had written, it was almost as if they had been doing the service themselves. And so now, going back to the 1970s when we were fighting for recognition, I was the president, and I sent out 17 questions to all of the WASPs that we could find, asking them to give me written proof of what they had done. So I have all of these letters, and I'm in the process, with the help of my daughter, Diana Potter, and son-in-law, Jeff Potter, of putting together another book which tells their stories. In other words, I told mine in my book. Now they're telling theirs in this book that we're putting together.
Do we know when that book will be out?
Well, I just heard a chuckle from the chair where Diana is sitting. She wants to put pictures, as many pictures as possible, in the book. And that is what she and Jeff are working on. Oh, within a year. Golly, I hope I live that long.
All right. Well, we are going to wrap things up. Bea, I wanted to just thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. This has been an absolute honor to not only myself, but the entire Chasing Earhart team, to have you aboard the project. So thank you so much for doing this today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's always good to let the world know what had been going on.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Chasing Earhart podcast, part of our Legacy retrospective series. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Come back to ChasingEarhart.com each week for another new podcast. While at ChasingEarhart.com, visit our archives and our blog to hear all of our past episodes and interviews with guests such as Brad Meltzer, Tom Vinson, Candace Fleming, Jessica Cox, Abigail Harrison, and Shasta Ways. You can also hear interviews with representatives of all of the relevant hypotheses regarding the disappearance of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan, such as Tom King, Dick Spink, Gary LaPook, Rick Gillespie, Andy Sherrill, and more. Also at our site, you can find hundreds more posts, project updates, and much more information regarding the life and disappearance of Amelia Earhart. The Chasing Earhart podcast is a show without any sponsors or ads. We rely on support from listeners like you to keep the Chasing Earhart project operating. You can donate to the show, and as our thank you, receive bonus podcasts, merchandise, and advanced opportunities for Chasing Earhart events. Find a full list of available shows and rewards at patreon.com/chasingearhart. You can also follow the project on social media, where our team posts all of our shows, news, and project information. And that hashtag is @ChasingEarhart. The Chasing Earhart podcast is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by Tom Myers. Podcast music is provided by Dane Jarris Schmidt, and narration is done by Forrest Burgess. The opinions on Chasing Earhart are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. Chris Evan Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All movie clips and audio used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of historical education, and no infringement is intended. The Chasing Earhart podcast is an exclusive trademark of Chris Evan Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. The Chasing Earhart podcast is a Chris Evan Films production. Copyright 2018. All rights reserved.